It's Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Farad. You're with us here in the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up on Central Time, Afghan President Ashraf Ghani is in Washington this week, and the U.S. announced it's leaving more troops in the country through 2015. That and more from the nation's capital.
First, we're talking about some big business news. Today, food giants Kraft and Heinz announced they're merging in a deal orchestrated by Warren Buffett and a Brazilian private equity firm. The combined company will be called Kraft Heinz Co. and will be one of the world's largest food and beverage companies. The deal is of particular interest here in Wisconsin, the home of Kraft's Oscar Mayer headquarters.
Our Central Time economics correspondent is here to break down this news for us. Chris Farrell is senior economics contributor at Marketplace and the author of Unretirement. Chris, thanks for joining us again.
Oh, well, thank you for having me.
So this is a merger between two real household names, a couple of the biggest names in packaged food. But from the economy perspective, the business perspective, how big a deal is this?
I actually think this is a pretty big deal. The numbers are big. The combined company is expected to have a market valuation, depending on whose numbers you're using, somewhere between $80 billion and $110 billion. This is the kind of merger that seizes attention. This is, I expect that we'll have ripple effects, increase mergers and acquisitions in the overall food area as people try and beef up, no pun intended, in terms of, you know, competing and competing for shelf space. So yeah, I think this has some fairly big implications throughout the economy, and particularly when we're thinking about mergers and acquisitions.
Now, these are measured in tens of billions of dollars.
Yeah.
Our interaction at the supermarket is probably $1.49 at a time. How are we going to be affected as consumers when we're at the grocery store?
You know, I think that the impact on the consumer in the grocery store will be relatively modest, very small. A lot of this deal is structured to lower costs. You know, if you look at Kraft, for example, Kraft just hasn't had much revenue growth. It really hasn't grown much. The whole food sector is in a lot of turmoil, particularly with your old line brand name iconic companies like Kraft, or you think about Kellogg in the cereal business. And part of it reflects changing consumer tastes, particularly among younger people wanting healthier foods, kind of want to know where their food's coming from, a little bit of rebellion against processed food. And this is really a long-term trend, and Kraft has reacted slowly to it. So I think that this really reflects changes in the marketplace, and these old brands are trying to revive themselves. And what this deal is going to do is allow for a lot of efficiencies on the cost side. I think that's what's going to be the real impact is going to be on the employees, the suppliers, the vendors. I think they're really going to see a big impact, and it's going to be fast and it's going to be harsh. As far as the consumer goes, you'll probably have just as much choice as before.
Well, some of those employees are here in Wisconsin. I mean, when there's a merger like this, I know we don't know details on this particular one, but when we see a merger like this, does that often mean plant closings around the world?
Yes. I mean, if you just think about a merger with big companies, by definition, it's a consolidation, and they're going to reap efficiencies. You would add an extra layer with this one, which is that one of the big players here is 3G, and this is the Brazilian private equity firm. And they're really good in the food business. They really are. They're also unbelievably good at cutting costs. So they're legendary at it. And so, yes, I would absolutely expect that they will be ruthless in going through the cost structure. They don't have any attachment to the way we used to do business. And so, yeah, I think that the current employees, quite a few of them probably are going to lose their jobs, and life is going to be a lot harder for the ones who remain.
Talking about the merger between food giants Kraft and Heinz with Central Times economic correspondent Chris Farrell of Marketplace. Chris, you mentioned maybe a little slow to innovate, Kraft, maybe Heinz too. Sometimes you think of smaller, nimbler companies being able to change with the times. They've just made a much bigger company by merging together. Are they going to be able to innovate out of some of these problems that have been holding them back?
Well, that's the $64,000 question. Now, again, part of it is I think these efficiencies, and you know, with 3G and Warren Buffett, who provide a lot of the financing, and Warren Buffett and 3G took Heinz private a couple of years ago. You know, these are longer term players, and one of the things that is intriguing, and you know, kind of hints a little bit about the question you're raising about innovation, is that Kraft was really part of a dismemberment of the old Kraft, and what remained that was called Kraft was a domestic U.S. company, largely. And Heinz has a very active, thriving international business. So again, you're recreating a giant food company that's going to have, you know, a well-known domestic position here in the U.S., and because of Heinz, is going to have, you know, a growing part of it overseas. And so I would expect to see some of the innovations, if you think about innovation in the food industry, an awful lot of it actually is coming from overseas and bringing some of those ideas here. So, but by and large, I mean, you know, at least the initial focus is going to be on the cost cutting, but cost cutting only gets you so far. You also have to grow with innovation. And so we'll see.
Now, you mentioned Warren Buffett involved with this. If there's one investor in this country who's close to a household name, it's him. Is this the kind of thing we expect Warren Buffett to be in the middle of?
This is exactly the kind of thing we expect Warren Buffett to be in the middle of. He loves brand name companies. So the huge position that he has in Coca-Cola, the big position that he had in Gillette. He used to have a big position in Kraft, and then he disagreed with some activities by the previous CEO, and so he got out of it. So he loves brand names. And the thing about it is, by pairing up with 3G, which is what he did the Heinz deal, and then also the Burger King with taking over Horton up in Canada, you know, Warren Buffett is able to be the cuddly investor, the wise man, and then 3G, they do the hard work, they do the tough work, and it's working for both of them. It's a good partnership.
Now, when we see a merger like this, just because both sides end up agreeing on it, doesn't mean it happens, right? The government weighs in on whether particular mergers happen?
Yes. The government always takes a look, particularly at a merger this size. Now, as far as I can see, I don't think there's going to be a whole lot of concern about antitrust. There's a lot of big players in this business. There's a lot of competition in the business. Maybe there might be an area too, but I would be really surprised. I think the antitrust concerns are minimal, and again, more I would be worried about from the point of view this is going to be employees being squeezed, maybe suppliers being squeezed, vendors being squeezed. But I think from the consumer point of view, it's not really much of an anti-competitive move.
You mentioned earlier, you think we could see more of this kind of thing happening in the food industry. Bigger picture, do you think this is a merger signaling something in terms of business trends in general and other industries too?
Absolutely, because if you think about a merger, there are two ingredients. I mean, at one form, even though, again, I say that, you know, this merger is a lot about cost cutting, you know, there's an optimism with mergers. You have to believe that at the end of the day, you have a stronger company, and you're going to sell more product. And so there's a certain optimistic level that goes with mergers and acquisitions. And the economy has been getting stronger. The unemployment rate's coming down. And I think this reflects an unleashing of the animal spirits of capitalism again. At the same time, you know, a lot of it matters what's the price. And the cost of capital is really low. I mean, the fact of the matter is there was not a bank that big bank that participated in negotiating this merger. It was two boutique investment banks, and it's Warren Buffett and it's 3G and it's the two companies, and they made this deal. So I think it's a combination of relatively cheap financing and an improving economy and increasing optimism. Now's the time to do a deal, because eventually the cost of capital is going to get more expensive. Eventually interest rates are going to go up. So why not strike now?
So this is a time to merge more or less on the cheap.
Yes.
All right, Chris, thank you as always for explaining these things to us.
Thanks a lot. I appreciate it.
That was Central Time economics correspondent Chris Farrell. He is senior economics contributor at Marketplace, and he's the author of the book Unretirement, with us to talk about the merger between Kraft and Heinz.
We're heading to Washington for our weekly look at national politics with USA Today's Washington correspondent Paul Singer.
The House is voting on their budget today. It's employing a unique tactic to appease Republicans who want more defense spending and Republicans who don't.
Also, the new president of Afghanistan is speaking at a joint session in Congress after news yesterday that the United States will slow its withdrawal of troops from Afghanistan in 2015. Paul Singer joins us every Wednesday at this time. Paul, welcome back.
Hello, Veronica. How are you?
I'm doing well, thanks. Well, let's start by talking budget. What's going on with the House vote on the budget today?
Oh, who knows? It's the, you know, the mysteries of Congress. They couldn't really decide how to solve their problem of wanting several different things at once. They wanted a lean, austerity kind of budget that didn't spend too much money. They wanted to somehow get around the sequester caps so that they could raise spending for the Pentagon. And since they weren't able to figure out how to do those things at the same time, they put them in two different bills, and they'll vote on all of them. And this is Congress at its most entertaining. They are going to have what they call a Queen of the Hill series of votes. Well, they'll vote on several different budget scenarios, and the one that gets the most votes wins. And so what we think they'll do is they'll pass a budget that is austere and does not include the defense spending, and then they'll vote on the next one, which is the same budget with the defense spending, and that'll get more votes than the last one, so they'll call that the winner.
It sounds like kind of a Baroque way to do things. What is sort of the point of going through that exercise?
Oh, you know, politics. The advantage is that it gives everybody an opportunity to say, I voted to do X and Y. You know, that was my preferred option. And so they can say, I voted for the preferred option, and they don't have to just vote no on the last option. And the last option's funny also because it's a budget bill that would include, I think it's a $2 billion increase for defense spending, but it's off the books. It doesn't count. It's magic money. So you need, if your budget is supposed to balance, you know, it's supposed to balance spending and revenues, you just hide a bunch of money in some account that is not part of the calculation. So the $2 billion literally doesn't count as if it was spent magically.
Is this kind of fun for you as someone who watches
this
to see all of this? I mean, the Queen of the Hill for one thing, and
And then in the Senate, we'll have what they call a votorama, which is starting tomorrow, because they can't figure out how to come to a deal either. They're just going to allow votes on dozens of amendments, and it'll take them like all night. Wait. For, I don't know, 30 hours of voting.
Votorama. You didn't just make that up. That's a real thing.
I did not. No. I did not make that up. Votorama. Ask any nerd who spent too much time in Washington, and they'll tell you what a votorama is.
All right. Well, what's next for the budget after the House votes?
Well, I mean, the Senate's got to vote. The House has to vote. They have to sit down, and then they have to come up with some kind of a deal because they'll have two different bills. They've got to negotiate them out. And then, of course, they have to get those two passed through the House and the Senate. And the deadline is April 15th, in theory. And, of course, it's all non-binding. This is one of those things where the budgets that pass don't really do anything. It's just sort of an outline that then Congress tries to stick to when they set up the spending bills for the year. So, full of sound and fury signifying nothing.
It doesn't have the potential to be influential, at least as a document, to refer to as the year progresses.
Yeah. Well, that's why they pass them. I mean, the whole idea is it's supposed to kind of give the outlines of how the budget's going to unfold, and it does set the spending caps for each of the committees that's responsible for, you know, appropriations bills. Really it's symbolic and it's political. I mean, it gives everybody an opportunity to say, I voted for a budget that does X and Y, or conversely, I did not vote for a budget that would have done X and Y. In this case, these are both Republican budgets, so the Democrats are looking at them as, well, you know, these things would slash Medicare. They would convert it into a privately funded program, or maybe a privately operated program instead of a government entitlement. We don't want to vote for that. And so for them, for Democrats, an opportunity to say, see, that's what Republicans want to do. And for Republicans, it's an opportunity to say, see, that's what we want to do. But it doesn't actually do what they want it to do. It just says they do.
Well, so speaking of going on the record, there's been a lot of wrangling back and forth over wording about abortion in some bills that don't seem to have that much to do explicitly with abortion. What's going on there?
It's an old saw, and I teach my students this problem, is if you want to, you know, make a mess out of a bill, you just add, you know, two words referring to abortion. In this case, there is a standing amendment that gets attached to the spending bill every year that says no federal funding should be expended to provide abortions. And some of the Republicans have decided to add versions of that language to other bills. And Democrats have resisted because they believe that it is extending those limits into other areas where they don't currently apply, or making it more permanent, or whatever. In theory, it should just be restating what is existing law, but Democrats believe that in some cases it is in fact extending the law and limiting abortions more. So Republicans have added this language to two different things. One is a bill on human trafficking that had a lot of bipartisan support, and the other is a bill they thought they had a deal on what's called the DOC fix. It's something way too complicated for me to explain, but it has something to do with making sure that Medicare reimbursement rates for doctors don't suddenly plummet. Well, both those bills were moving along, and then they added this abortion language, and then an argument ensued, and then the bills both stopped. Now, I am told just in the past little while that there may be a deal to change that language in such a way that it's less offensive to Democrats and that will liberate those bills, but I haven't seen how that works yet.
Right now, we're getting our weekly dose of news from Capitol Hill with Paul Singer in our On Congress segment. And, Paul, you're talking about these bills being bipartisan in large part, the human trafficking bill. So what are advocates of the bill doing? I mean, what options do they have? Well, this abortion language, which isn't really central to the bill, is holding it up.
Well, no, they don't really have much. I mean, all they can do is turn to the sponsors of the amendments and say, take it off the bill. You're screwing up something that would be otherwise worthwhile. And, of course, the sponsors of the amendments are going to say, no, though, you know, we have to make sure that this bill does not violate our opposition to abortion. And it becomes, again, a political showdown less than a policy showdown. And the funny thing about the human trafficking bill is apparently the language was in there for a couple of weeks, and the Democrats just failed to notice. And then it came down to the last, moment to vote, and they were like, wait a minute, what is this language here? Hold it. We don't like that. We can't support that. So, you know, it's just part of this is just part of the dance. You know, Republicans who are particularly strong advocates of getting rid of abortion are looking for every opportunity to do so. And any time they can make a statement like that on a bill that's likely to pass, they're going to take that opportunity.
And disapproval of the goings-on in Congress, you know, that's at a high lately. Is this the sort of thing that you can point to say, look, here's something that has support and yet it's being held up?
Yeah, the sad thing is that, and I'll take some blame for this. This is what I do for a living. You know, we write about the stuff that is heavy on the conflict, and these are the stories that end up occupying all of the conversation. It's not whether or not you can pass a simple bill to do something smart on trafficking. It's how much wrangling you're going to do over abortion. I mean, you may or may not have noticed that the Afghan president is speaking in front of the U.S. Congress today, and it seems like that news story gets more or less buried because nobody cares anymore. But when Netanyahu spoke and everybody was angry and it was a who's poking who in the eye, it dominated the news for 3 days.
Right. Well, let's not bury it anymore. Let's talk about that. What message does the president of Afghanistan have for Washington this week?
Well, he's got two messages. One is that I'm not Hamid Karzai. We were getting very frustrated with the previous leadership of Afghanistan, and I think the Americans are very, very glad to have a guy they think they can work with. And I think the second part of his message was that what he was saying is really expressing some gratitude for the amount of blood and money that the United States has spent trying to rescue Afghanistan from chaos. He came up with a deal with Obama yesterday that would basically slow down our withdrawal of troops from Afghanistan, leaving about 9,500 troops in Afghanistan for a little while longer, in part because I think the Americans now feel like they have a political partner they can rely on that they didn't have in Karzai. And so part of this speech and this presentation and this message was, this is a new day in the partnership. We can actually make some progress together. There is a future here that America wants to be part of. But again, I'm sort of embarrassed at how quickly it emerges and disappears from all of our new news websites because it wasn't that exciting.
Have you heard any sort of feedback or play about the slowdown of the troop withdrawal in Afghanistan? Is it largely considered a good thing in Congress?
I think so, yeah. I mean, there has not been a great deal of objection. I mean, I suspect there will be some objection I mean, it's difficult when you keep asking people to go back in the field, keep asking troops to go back in the field, right? I mean, that's going to continue to be a problem, and it's going to continue to generate some opposition. But no, I mean, there's been pretty much bipartisan support for the speech and for the new president. And, you know, I don't think there's been a great deal of objection to the idea of leaving some troops there and trying to make sure that we help Afghanistan remain stable.
And Paul, we've just got a little sliver of time left here, but some breathing room, it looks like, for President Obama on a nuclear deal with Iran. What's the latest there?
Yeah, it looks like the Congress is not in a hurry to vote on this, giving Obama a few more weeks. It looks like it'd be two or three more weeks before Congress is really firm on trying to take up a bill or something that would try and force Obama's hand. So they've given him a little more wiggle room to see if they can get a deal with Iran in the next couple of weeks.
Great. We'll leave it there. Paul, thanks a lot for joining us.
Thanks, Veronica. Talk to you soon.
We've been speaking with USA Today Washington correspondent Paul Singer. He joins us every Wednesday at this time to talk about the latest from Capitol Hill.
You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Farah.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. Industries and institutions from health to media have transformed dramatically over the past century. New inventions, economic growth, the internet have changed our world in immeasurable ways.
In spite of all that change, one key institution has remained largely unchanged, our higher education system. According to education policy expert Kevin Carey, our universities in a lot of ways today look like they did 100 years ago. But he says that's about to change.
Exploding costs, record-breaking debt, and questions over the actual outcomes of higher education are forcing the industry to reinvent itself, and to do so using the tools that other industries have been embracing for years, things like the internet, big data, and crowdsourcing.
Kevin Carey joins us now. He's director of the Education Policy Program at the New America Foundation. His new book is called The End of College, Creating the Future of Learning and the University of Everywhere. Kevin, thanks for joining us today.
Great to be here.
Well, the basics, your premise is our college system as it stands is deeply flawed. Big picture, how so?
Well, the cost of going to higher education has increased enormously over the last three decades to the point where for a lot of middle-class families, it's become an immense financial burden just to send a couple of kids to a good college and get them through. At the same time, there's a lot of new research that suggests that many students, including those who graduate, really aren't learning that much in our colleges and universities, which don't challenge them with rigorous curriculum or even really pay enough attention to how much they're learning while they're there. Colleges and universities really have not changed in any fundamental way since their basic design, as we know it now, was created in the late 19th century. They've used information technology to kind of sustain themselves but not really transform themselves. I think that the long-term cost problem in higher education, which is both a function of colleges being inefficient but also a function of state governments pulling money out of higher education, is really moving us toward a breaking point where we're going to have to come up with new organizational models that use information technology to provide a great education to all kinds of students, but not break the bank at the same time.
We'll get into how those models can change in a bit. I want to get into some of the history you cover. You go back about 1,000 years. For now, let's go back about 100. And you say at the inception of the modern era of college, there were three alternate viewpoints. Our universities, our colleges, be in effect workplace training, something to benefit the economy, or they could be research institutions, or they could be liberal arts colleges. And faced with that decision, the answer is yeah, sure, all of those. So that's one of the fundamental flaws you see with what's happened since.
I think that's right, and to be clear, that's not a thesis that I developed originally for this book. It was actually first put forth in a book by the higher education historian Lawrence Veazey, in a book that he wrote 50 years ago. Lawrence Veazey actually worked at the University of Wisconsin-Madison for a couple of years early in his career before going out to UC Santa Cruz, where he did most of his work. But exactly right. There really was this great debate after the Civil War, where some people said we should be training people for jobs, and some people said, no, we should be like the German research university, and some people said, no, it's really important to embrace the liberal arts education ideals. We kind of scrunched all three of those things into one institution with some really strange results. It's very odd, I think, that we have a higher education system in which the highest credential, the PhD, is one that does not require people to have any training in pedagogy or teaching methods. Particularly at research universities, we promote and pay professors almost entirely by their prowess as scholars, not their prowess as teachers. Colleges like to pretend that those two things go together, but they really don't in many cases. Often teaching is sacrificed in favor of research, and I think students really suffer as a consequence.
Well, and that brings me to a point you touched on right at the outset there. We're paying a lot for our universities, but students may be not learning that much. Do we have consistent ways of knowing what students learn in their 4 or 5 or 6 year journey to a bachelor's degree?
We really don't. We just kind of trust that colleges are doing the right thing. And remarkably, given the number of very, very smart researchers who live and work on college campuses, there's very little solid empirical evidence that would actually meet the standards that scholars hold themselves to when it comes to publishing that would allow a particular university to make any kind of solid claims about how much students are actually learning between the time that they arrive and the time that they leave. And it's this funny thing when colleges say, we've raised our academic standards, what they often mean is, we've raised our entrance standards. Our median SAT score has gone up. But that's a measure of how smart students were when they arrived, not how much they learned while they were there.
And another measure that you write about, and this is kind of shocking in some ways, is one way that colleges signal their quality and the rigorous standards is by increasing tuition.
And this is really a consequence of not having any information about quality. If you want to have a market that functions on a sense of value, you need to know both price and quality so you can put the two things together, because that's all value is. Quality divided by price. If we don't know what quality is, then price and quality become confused with one another. And we see that a lot, particularly in the upper echelons of higher education, where a lot of institutions become elite by charging elite prices. There's almost this assumption that if you charge the same tuition as Harvard, you must be as good at Harvard. That's been a way that a lot of colleges have sort of climbed the status ladder and used that money to build fancy gyms and nicer facilities and recruit certain kinds of faculty, but it's the parents and students that really get left with the bill, and increasingly that bill is being expressed in terms of debt. We now have over $1.2 trillion in outstanding student loan debt in America, more even than we have in credit card debt.
We're talking to Kevin Carey from the New America Foundation about the future of higher education and his new book, The End of College. Kevin, let's start getting into solutions. One area that you point to as bearing a lot of potential for change, for improvement, is the use of online education, online technology. Where do you see the best hopes for improvement?
Yeah, we live in a kind of an amazing time where you can now log on to your computer and take full, complete classes from some of the best universities in the world, including Harvard and MIT. I actually took an entire MIT genetics class in writing the book. This is exactly the same class that MIT offers to its own freshmen. Same lectures, same problem sets, same exams, same grades. There were 100 people in Cambridge, Massachusetts taking this class, and about 10,000 people around the world taking it online. People as young as 13 years old, as old as 85, from almost every nation on earth. It didn't cost any of us a dollar. It was offered completely free through the edX online platform. Now, to be clear, I don't see the future of higher education for most people as being purely online. I think people will still want to live and learn with other people. For certain kinds of people, college isn't just about taking classes. It's also a coming-of-age experience where you experience extracurriculars and you're exposed to diverse viewpoints. All these things that many of our fondest memories of going to college, if we were lucky to go to college. My argument is that you can do both at the same time, however. You can create places that provide that coming-of-age experience, that socialization, that provide face-to-face contact with other students and people. But if you use all of the tremendous new resources that are now available and will become available in the future educationally, you can build institutions that aren't nearly as expensive or elaborate as the ones that we have now and actually provide a better education.
And another idea you mentioned is extending your college career basically through your lifetime. I think you use the analogy of a cathedral. It's not a place you go to for 4 years and you're done. You continue your university education through your life. How would that work?
that, you know, people need to learn throughout their lives. They want to learn throughout their lives. We don't live in a world where you train for a certain job and then just have that job for 20 or 30 or 40 years. People constantly need to be keeping up with a very fast-changing world around them. And college is also not just about, of course, having skills for employment. It's also about learning to be a better person, learning to live a more enlightened life. One of the reasons that I think a lot of colleges have fallen down in providing access to a really good liberal arts education is that I don't think that you can learn all you need to know from a liberal arts standpoint in as short as 4 years. But 4 years is the number that we came up with a long time ago, and it's very expensive to engage in higher education, traditionally speaking. So I think that in the future, education and our relationship with colleges and educational organizations will be more lifelong, maybe a little bit closer to our relationship with organizations of faith. So enough of a financial and time commitment that you're engaged with it maybe once a week for a few hours, maybe more than that, but not so much that you can't also have a family and a job and a life at the same time.
We're talking to Kevin Carey, author of The End of College, about how technology and costs are changing higher education in the United States.
And we'd like to hear from you at 800-642-1234. If you're in college now, or maybe your child is, do you think higher education is working the way it should? What problems do you see with higher education in the U.S., and what is working well? How would you change things, and what role do you see for technology? Call 800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page. We're continuing our conversation about the future of higher education with Kevin Carey, director of the Education Policy Program at the New America Foundation.
And you can join in at 800-642-1234. If you've had a college experience recently, how'd it work for you? If you could redesign it, what would you do differently? Have you taken an online course, either all by itself or as part of your education? Call in now at 800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page. Go right to a caller now. We've got Dan with us in Wakefield, Michigan. Dan, hi.
Hello, how's everybody?
Good. What did you want to bring up, Dan?
Well, I teach at a community college in the Western Upper Peninsula, and I'm in my 30th year, but I taught high school for 22 years. In order to teach high school, I had to be highly qualified and certified. I'm amazed at the junior college level and at universities, teachers don't need certification, almost as if anybody can teach. And I do think there are some good teachers without certification, but it does water down the requirements, and it seems opposite. If K-12 has to be, why not higher ed?
Dan, thanks for the call. Kevin, what do you think of that?
Yeah, it is a kind of a strange situation. There's actually quite a bit of curricular overlap between the latter years of high school and the first couple of years of college, particularly in community colleges. So the idea that our collective sense of what the qualifications are to be good at that job suddenly changes radically when students go from being 18 years old to 19 years old is odd. And it's just kind of historical happenstance that just is sort of where the line was drawn. And it sort of shows how in some ways certain kinds of ideas and value systems that might kind of have made sense for very elite research universities have filtered down all throughout our higher education system. And so we have community colleges where, the professors there are not teaching a couple of classes and spending all the time in the laboratory. They're often teaching five whole classes a semester. Their job is almost wholly focused on teaching a very diverse array of students. Some of them are very good, but they do come from different kinds of backgrounds. Those kind of colleges often don't get the same sort of financial support from governments as more elite institutions. That really is where I think we need to put a lot of our investment and where there are actually a lot of opportunities to wisely integrate information technology into some good community-focused organizations that are already there.
Speaking of investment, before we get back to callers, Kevin, I saw you quoted in the Chronicle of Higher Education the idea being that, well, hey, if you're saying our current college system is obsolete, does that mean states, the federal government, shouldn't be supporting them as much?
No, exactly the opposite. We need more public support for higher education. The system we have now is really deeply inequitable. We provide far more money to institutions that educate students from wealthier backgrounds, students from higher socioeconomic classes, and we provide less money to institutions that educate first-generation students, low-income students, minority students, immigrant students. That needs to change. That issue is something that needs to happen at the same time that we work to make sure that all of our higher education institutions really do take full advantage of the opportunity to improve themselves and in some ways transform themselves given what is now possible with information technology.
We'll go back to our callers. We've got Marina on the line in Pleasant Prairie. Marina, hi.
Yes. Hello, I have two comments, and I'll listen to your response afterwards. Good afternoon. My first comment has to do with, actually, I was always curious about the origins of higher education, as back in the day when you was basically reserved for your upper class, and the working class usually went into the apprenticeship, okay, and it's almost today, you have, you know, more access to it, but you still have that division because of the boss. The last statement I had to make, I have a daughter that attends UWW. My biggest beef I noticed with education is this organic chemistry instructor, she came from MIT. A lot of times, the unfortunate part is that an educator or a professor in this case, they don't realize the purpose of education is to teach, is to convey the information.
Gotcha, Marina. I want to jump in and get our guest to respond now, UW-Whitewater. So first, Kevin, class distinctions in modern education.
Well, higher education is all bound up in our ongoing kind of collective debate about class, and I think the caller was exactly right. Higher education used to be much more for the elite, and then in the mid-20th century, sort of starting with the GI Bill and moving through the expansion of a lot of our university and community college systems, we now have a system of mass higher education. Somewhere between 75 and 80% of students who graduate from high school will go into a college of some kind by their mid-20s. We don't have much of a job training system in this country. Higher education is where it happens. In a lot of ways, that's part of the problem. We rely on both financially and institutionally our colleges and universities to, for certain broad parts of the workforce, provide critical training and credentials. But often these are institutions that in some ways either explicitly or implicitly look down on the vocational part of their mission. That vocational is not a word that a lot of colleges even want to associate themselves with, and I think that's too bad. I think good institutions both expose people to the sciences and the humanities, but also provide practical skills that you can use to get a job. And particularly if students are going to walk out into the workforce with debt, as 70% of all students with bachelor's degrees now borrow an average of $30,000, they have to be able to get a good job to pay those loans back.
Talking to Kevin Carey from the New America Foundation about his new book, The End of College. And related to Marina's second point there, we had a comment from Sarah on Facebook. This is Sarah Goldrick-Rabb, a researcher here at UW, guest on the show from time to time. She says, Kevin Carey claims that faculty don't care about teaching, know how to teach or prioritize teaching. What evidence does he have for this? Sounds like he's talking about a small number of faculty at a certain type of university.
Well, I mean, the book actually goes into great length about that. This is an observation that isn't just being made by me now. This has been made almost from the beginning of the design of the system. In, I think, the early 20th century, right around 1901, William James, the famous pragmatist philosopher at Harvard, brother of Henry James, the novelist, wrote a long essay called The PhD Octopus, where he bemoaned the fact that colleges all of a sudden had decided that you needed to have a PhD in order to teach in the classroom, even though the things that you did to get a PhD had really nothing to do with whether or not you were good at the classroom. So it's not really a question of intent. There are a lot of great teachers in American higher education, and I think the vast majority of people who go into the teaching business very much want to be good at their jobs, but they're put in a difficult position. they aren't trained to be teachers. It's just a fact that in order to get a PhD, you do not have to go through any kind of, as our previous caller said, any kind of like legitimate program of teacher training or pedagogy. It's also a fact that if you want to be promoted at some place like the University of Wisconsin-Madison, research is the name of the game. The publish-or-perish system is still the way things work in academia. There is no teach-or-perish system for promotion and getting tenure at the major research universities, and it's the research universities that really provide cues to the rest of the profession and the rest of the system about the kind of values that institutions embrace.
In our last couple of minutes, Kevin, I want to look toward your vision for the future. You talk about the University of Everywhere. What, 10 years from now, say you've got a 7-year-old now, what might their college experience look like in a decade?
I think that here's what's going to change. I have a 4-year-old now, so I've got a little more time to save and prepare for higher education. I think right now, if she were to go to college right now, she would have one kind of option. There's really only one kind of institution to go to, and as we've said, it was an institution that was probably designed a long time ago. 15 years from now, I think there will be three options. There will still be some traditional colleges or institutions that have the names of institutions that we now see as traditional colleges to go to. There will be some higher education organizations that exist mostly, I don't even want to say online, because I think that that bespeaks a very kind of limited sense of how we're going to interact with computers in the future. It's not all going to be sitting in front of a monitor, kind of with a keyboard. Human-computer interaction is going to get much better and more fluid and more human in the future. And then there's going to be a third option, which will be having a relationship with new higher education organizations that are places where you actually leave home. Probably my daughter will want to leave home when she's 18, just like I did, like just like lots of people do. You leave home, you move somewhere, you live among other students, you live among adults who are older and wiser than you, who can help mentor you and move you through college. But these are organizations that will be built from the ground up, to fully take advantage both educationally and economically of all that information technology can offer.
We'll leave it there. That was Kevin Carey. His new book is The End of College.
Sorry, I just lost my mind just for a moment. But that's okay for me, because I am a wild and crazy guy.
That performance from comedian Steve Martin and the album it's on went into the archives of history this week, literally, along with 24 other recordings. The Library of Congress announced the newest round of entries into the National Recording Registry.
The registry was created by Congress back in 2010 as part of an effort to preserve the nation's audio history. With 25 editions this year, the grand total is up to 425 preserved recordings, including some from wax cylinders recorded in the 19th century.
Along with Martin, this year's class included recordings from Joan Baez, The Doors, Radiohead, a British band is there for some reason, blues artist Blind Lemon Jefferson, and the funeral of Franklin D. Roosevelt and more. We've got a link to more info over at the Central Time Facebook page.
We go to the news now with one of the more recent additions, Ben E. King with the classic Stand By Me.
When the night has come and the land is dark and the moon is the only light we'll see.